This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello and welcome, dear listeners, to the fourth episode of the Urban Political Podcast mini-series on cities and geopolitics. Just a reminder that we are producing this series in collaboration with the Second Cold War Observatory and Urban Geography Journal. In our last episode, we explored urbanization and geopolitics through the infrastructure lens, using the examples of Lobito Corridor in Angola, port infrastructures in Greece, and infrastructures at the borders connecting China, northeastern India, and Myanmar. Using these examples, our guests in the last episode explored the puzzle of how infrastructures help attain network centrality amidst geopolitical competition. How these infrastructures are at the same time also contingent, and how they allow control, and how can they switch as well, depending on a range of contingencies. So it is this latter part that we're interested in exploring further today. How geopolitical urbanization is not merely contingent, but also gives rise to competing forms of world making, and how cities and eccentric urbanizing regions and territories shaped by geopolitical competition and economic processes serve as sites for imagining and constructing alternative urban futures. To help explore this puzzle in greater detail, we are joined by three excellent scholars whose research focuses on this subject at different scales and across different geopolitical geographies. So our first guest today is Wojciech Kiblowski. He's an assistant professor at the University of Hong Kong and a guest professor at Free University in Brussels. His research and photography explore the intersection of urban political economy, transport and mobility, global China, and the Belt and Road Initiative. Welcome to the podcast, Wojciech.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Our second guest is Sirma Altun. She's an assistant professor at the Department of Politics and Economics at Ankara University. She received her PhD from the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney in 2021. Her research interests include the political economy of China, spatial political economy, and international political economy with a specific focus on green and digital transformations. Sirma is also a research associate of the Second Cold War Observatory.
Hi, thank you very much.
And last but not least, we have Yong Zhang. He's an assistant professor of urban studies at College of Integrative Studies, Singapore Management University. He uses critical urban theory to examine how cities are governed in China and increasingly Southeast Asia, specifically looking at how policy changes reshape social spaces and urban life. Thanks for joining us, Yong.
Thank you. It's a pleasure coming here and carry on a conversation.
All right. I'm glad all of you are here, and thanks for agreeing to do this again. So my first question to you today is, how do global rivalries shape urban development, investment, and industrial policy? And what role do subnational actors play in mediating geopolitical processes? Maybe we can start with you, Wojciech.
Sure. Great questions. I'll try to begin unpacking them, although you could probably spend a whole day discussing those. I'll try to think about these questions from a particular place, a place that I've been researching going back to for the past 4 or 5 years now, which is at the border between Poland and Belarus, which is Poland's easternmost periphery or borderlands, but also the European Union's easternmost regions, and the place where perhaps it comes into interaction with Asia or Eurasia, however we define these continents and wherever we draw their boundaries. It's a place where what we traditionally would refer to as these geopolitical powers or empires met very frequently. We can trace it back to the 19th century, when the Imperial Russia built railroads connecting it with Europe, traversing today's eastern parts of Poland. Fast forwarding to the Second World War, when the Nazi Germany arrived with its infrastructural projects of bringing its troops to the Eastern Front, fighting the USSR, then these lands would be part of the socialist camp, stretching all the way from the Pacific to East Germany, when some kind of infrastructural project and facilities were needed to facilitate flows of goods and people within the socialist camp, notably between the USSR and East Germany, to the European Union project, and now to a lot of ideas and a lot of infrastructural facilities built focused on the globalization of Chinese interests and the exports of Chinese goods to Europe and vice versa. So from this particular place in the world, from this particular region, the border between Poland and Belarus, you can see indeed a lot of empires, a lot of geopolitical powers coming to contact or taking over this land or influencing it in whatever ways they see possible. And it's perhaps typical to look at this process from a very macro perspective, from a very kind of global geopolitical perspective, Imperial Russia, European Union, USSR, China, right? Where there is little space for regional, urban or rural actors or spaces or institutions. And perhaps as a way of countering this, I focus very much on what local actors can actually do, what local inhabitants can do when global China arrives knocking at the door, when the European Union is essentially failing to embrace them through cohesion policies that didn't really do much for these easternmost regions of the European Union, with continue to suffer from high unemployment and very low levels of industrialization. And essentially, well, the only way that you can prosper in that part of the world is to immigrate to either an urban center within Poland or go abroad to Western Europe. So I studied how local actors essentially embrace global China, how they try to promote the investment and expansion of local transshipment ports. These ports were built in the 1950s to facilitate the difference of railway gauge between the so-called Russian or imperial standard and the European standard that we use, for example, in Switzerland. And essentially, these ports, which were built in socialist times to negotiate, to facilitate traffic from USSR to East Germany, now they begin to be useful to facilitate cargo flows from China to Europe and vice versa. Now, what can the local actors do about this? I mean, it really is, again, a very kind of geopolitical, transnational, globalist project. Well, you could say that they have very limited agency in terms of trying to promote the expansion or renovation of this infrastructure. But what they actually do is that, well, they go to China, they actively maintain relations with the Chinese peers, so to speak, although they often meet representatives of institutions that are way more powerful than their own. They also lobby with national institutions. They go to Warsaw on what they call pilgrimages to Warsaw, where they try to muster some kind of support of national institutions and EU institutions to invest in these transshipment ports. And they really create this narrative, or they replicate this narrative, according to which they sit on a golden goose. They are at the gateway to Europe or gateway to Asia, whichever way you are looking at this, that has a lot of potential for the national economy, for Poland's economy, for the European economy. They are sitting in a strategic, geopolitically and geoeconomically place. So they actually master very, very macro geopolitical narratives in order to promote development, promote infrastructural development for the local livelihood, for local labor. Which is a bit of a paradox and perhaps a bit of a contradiction, but I find it quite fascinating how, in the end, these local actors are very active in harnessing macro geopolitical forces and narratives. Maybe I would leave it there for now.
Thanks, Wojciech. If I may have a very quick follow up there, like geography that you're sort of describing, one might argue, okay, that's a very rural geography as well. And of course, we're talking about cities and geopolitics here and urbanization. Like, how does urbanization manifest there? Or does it not? Like, do we need to understand this through a rural geography lens?
It's a very good question. Yeah, these lands are predominantly rural. I mean, you would not find large cities there, and this part of Poland has not essentially been urbanized the way that others have. But already in the socialist times, the construction of these transshipment ports led to urbanization processes. So you have a construction of a new town next to one of the ports, which was essentially dedicated to the railmen, as they were called at that time. So it was a town that was kept off the maps, where basically rail workers would be housed. You also have construction of some housing estates, housing neighborhoods next to other ports. There were as many as 10 ports constructed along Poland's eastern border. So this is no small amount. That's from a historical perspective. Moving more to the contemporary situation, well, the construction of logistical facilities, all kinds of types of infrastructure. There's a very diverse typology and related tensions in terms of noise pollution, traffic, etc. I think that you can see them as very urban processes and very urban dynamics. These are facilities that are essentially very much governed from some kind of urban centers of command and control, and very much with urban centers in mind. So these goods are essentially the urban hinterland, or these facilities are essentially an urban hinterland of urban centers that are lying somewhere either towards China or towards the center of the center of Europe. So I think we are very much dealing with urbanization of these rural spaces.
Very interesting. Thanks, Wojciech. So Sirma, I would like to maybe listen from you about this question, like how does it sort of manifest in the geography that you're studying?
Yeah, I can reflect on these questions based on my studies on Hong Kong, maybe. And in that sense, the first thing that comes to mind is the branding initiatives held by Hong Kong government since the handover, like a series of branding initiatives to position, and this is the official framing, so that makes it even more interesting, to position Hong Kong as Asia's world city. But Hong Kong is also a Chinese city. Hong Kong is also a global city in competition with, again, in the official rhetoric, London in Europe and New York in the US. Hong Kong is also, again, in the official framing, we see that emphasis is in competition or was in competition at the time with Singapore, with Seoul in South Korea, with Taipei. So the competition between the Asian cities. In all these contexts, to emphasize the unique position of the special administrative region, as a Chinese city located in the world, a series of branding initiatives was held, officially held in Hong Kong. In the first instance, of course, at the background, you have the post-colonial transformation, you have the handover, you have rising China, you have the relocation of Hong Kong industries to mainland, so you're talking about the industrialization. And you have, in a sense, Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland growth triangle. So it's in its heydays. Against all this background, what Hong Kong authorities was trying to do to position Hong Kong as an Asian Chinese global city. So, and it's highly difficult to do so in the framing, but they allocate significant amounts of resources and personnel and initiatives to do so. So the brand of Hong Kong changes over time in line with the changes, transformations in this branding framings, the popular framing transitioning from being the world city to a more cultural city, and Hong Kong kind of aligns with that shift in terms of branding itself as a cultural city as well. But in my work, I try to make the comparison between what we may call the first repositioning of Hong Kong after the handover and the second repositioning of Hong Kong in the 2020s. And now we have the context of the Second Cold War. Now we have US-China rivalry. In your first episode, Seth and Kevin talked a lot about it, the context of the Second Cold War. And now you have a recent China. Now you have Shenzhen not trying to repeat the Hong Kong miracle, but now establishing itself maybe a model to Hong Kong. And I'm sure Yong will tell us about it as well. Changing context on the international political economy level, and also changing framing of Hong Kong's positioning through city branding. But we cannot just, I guess, understand the local responses towards the international political economy or geopolitics, whatever you call it, in discursive senses, in in symbolic practices, we should also look at physical production of space coming from a Lefebvrean sense. The symbolic production of space and physical production of space, they go hand in hand, that they are internally related. So in that sense, what I try to do is to understand this Northern Metropolis mega project initiated in 2021 by actually Kerry Lam, but then continued from the 2021. It still continues. It's an ongoing effort. And we can also understand this mega project, physical production of space, internally related to second repositioning of Hong Kong through city branding initiatives. But maybe I'll unpack what I mean in the later questions as well.
Yeah, thanks, Irma. It seems like Hong Kong has always been ahead of the curve. Yong, do you perhaps want to come in?
All right. Thanks again for having me here. So I think my answer to this question would be based on my recent works in Shenzhen through the case study of its industrial policies as well as urban redevelopment reorientation. Honestly, I may come from a slightly different perspective as I has been trained as urban geographer planner for the past decade or so and doing research from a more kind of urban as assumption kind of perspective. So actually the geopolitical rivalry only comes to shore very lately in my research. For example, in the first paper I co-authored with, Chen Chen from, at that time she was working in Shenzhen, we find that Shenzhen has been composing a rather kind of peculiar policy in terms of land use and provision of industrial space, which is locally called industry going upstairs. In plain words, it basically means building the vertical factories that could extend to 100 meter high and accommodate the emerging industries that you can find listed on all kinds of policy documents, ranging from pharmaceutical companies, robotics, and so on and so forth, right? Those emerging industries. What's peculiar about this phenomenon is, as we all understand, I believe most of the audience will also understand that Shenzhen has been long regarded as a technological powerhouse and innovation center for China for the past maybe one or two decades after its earlier days establishment as a special economic zone. It's still quite kind of unusual why a Chinese city, right, with a big hinterland would shift its kind of like urban land use policy to such an extreme version that encouraged the vertical construction of industrial space. It's not like the Asian cities haven't seen this kind of urbanism, right? In Shenzhen, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, many people would take as a, in colloquial term, like teachers or shifu of Shenzhen, right? Where Shenzhen's development model on them, it's not as prevalent, right? There are cases where you see those vertical factories, but not as prevalent as Shenzhen. Where we're doing this research, we find that an important factor that drives the shift of this narrative, what we call this kind of repoliticalization of the manufacturing orientation. So for a long time, at least for dating back to two decades ago, it's a common sense that international division of labor will allow this kind of relatively footloose capital to choose the places it want, right? And allowing the more high margin industry to stay in the more competitive places where just let those, low skill or relatively less capitalized industries to go further to the hinterland, to the cheap places. But at the turning of 2016, epitomized by the, a controversy of Huawei's relocation or in rumor, right? Like of its R&D center to a neighbor city, Shenzhen government still start to realize that this natural ectasis of manufacturing has to be contained. It can no longer be treated as a natural process. And we find that as one of the major reasons why Shenzhen come up with this very aggressive, ambitious vertical factory building scheme. Another scheme, which talks about our research on the urban village redevelopment, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this phenomenon, but in cities like Shenzhen and many thousand China cities, and including some northern cities as well, many migrant workers, right, and young graduates from universities, they're not living in the shiny condos as we see in Manchester. They live in those kind of low rent, affordable, and sometimes congested spaces provided by the urban villages. Is there called urban village because the land was collectively owned by the rural collective? Well, they're designated rural in institutional sense, but not in the built environment sense, right? Because from outside, it can still look like a 10-story high self-built housing or something of that sort. But how does that related to the geopolitical rivalry, right? So what our research found was that a similar geographical pressure, including the industrial retention and the laboring production. So it comes with a classical question, right? We discussed in urban economics, you know, and so on and so forth, which is, do people follow work or work for people, right? With all those exodus of the manufacturing jobs from Shenzhen to hinterland China, understandably, a lot of jobs, opportunities, employment were follow path. But increasingly, when Shenzhen started to say, okay, we need to contend this exodus, we need not only to contend them by providing space, we need to fill in the space with talent. And they come to the conclusion, a realization that that kind of retention cannot be exclusive to the high talent, right? They cannot be exclusive to, people with PhD degrees or working experience in the Silicon Valley, but also the broader, more relatively primitive or low-skilled jobs as well. And then it comes to the idea of reproduction of labor, right? They cannot work in the office for 24 hours and 7 days a week. They have to come back. And those urban villages, which used to be called, I mean, I still clearly remember it because when I was doing my undergraduate in that similar region, there was a widely circulated saying, you know, the urban villages are like eyesores of the city. You know, because they're not good looking from outside, they don't fit into this kind of modernization narrative. But increasingly, they're cast into a different light for the similar reasons. So those two cases are my examples of how, you know, global rivalries can find its resonance in urban development, investment, and industry policy.
Thanks, Yong. And just to contextualize for listeners who might not be very familiar with the geography of Shenzhen and Hong Kong. These are two cities that are right next to each other across the border of the Hong Kong province, Hong Kong when it was also a British protectorate. And Shenzhen, in fact, developed vis-a-vis. So just to connect these cases also for the listeners. And Wojciech, you're sort of sitting in Hong Kong at the moment, right? So yes, my next question I'm going to pose to you, and I want to start with you because your case kind of defies certain logics of cities. You are actually in what can be understood as an eccentric transshipment city. You're sort of describing an eccentric transshipment city. So I'll be very interested in how you think of the next question. So which is, how are cities repositioning within this shifting global economic order? And what kind of urban futures are emerging through these transformations?
Again, very interesting questions and tricky to unpack in such a short time, but I'll give it a try. I think that the place that I've studied, so however we define it, transshipment infrastructure or these kind of rural communities that surround it, or indeed this whole assemblage of these infrastructural and rural spaces that are actually experiencing or have experienced different rounds of urbanization, I think their very existence as kind of nodes for logistical flows and the very arrival and continued development of urbanization are very closely related to these shifts of global economic orders. Were it not for these shifts, this place or these places would probably not really be relevant, I mean, at least for our discussion. So if we start from indeed this arrival of Imperial Russian state to these lands and its willingness to connect itself to Europe, from which emerged the idea and the need to build railroads, not one, not two, but three that would connect Warsaw. At that point, the easternmost city of Imperial Russia, Poland at that point, was partitioned between Russia, Prussia and Austria, to St. Petersburg and to Moscow and to Minsk. So we start with that. That basically is when these lands begin to function as more than just rural communities. They are now close to an imperial railroad, which brings jobs, which brings livelihood, which brings identity, which brings the state as well with its power. We move to the USSR, to the kind of construction of the socialist camp and its embrace of these lands in the aftermath of the Second World War and the beginning of the First Cold War. That concept was very evoked and also very much discussed by Seth and Kevin in the first episode of the podcast. So with the arrival of the First Cold War, again, these communities or this urbanization actually makes sense or is initiated by this geo-economic or geopolitical shift, because now that these lands are within the socialist camp, there is an infrastructural glitch, the difference of the gauge that I already referred to, and the need to actually play some infrastructural trick or create some kind of infrastructural solution to the fact that the trains are essentially running on two different types of tracks. So how do you send goods from USSR to East Germany and vice versa? Well, the trains have to stop and goods have to be moved. And who moves these goods? Well, it's the men and women of the local communities, which again means that there is labor, there is livelihood, there is meaning, there is identity, and there is urbanization as a result. Without this, without the shift of the geoeconomic, geopolitical power, without the wind changing from eastwards to westwards and vice versa, there would not be much happening in the geopolitical and geoeconomic sense. There would be plenty of other things going on, of course, but again, we would not really be having a conversation about these places. And I think this is very much also related to what the future holds. As the European, the EU project of, let's say, I'm simplifying here, but some kind of globalization under a very neoliberal paradigm essentially failed these lands, which failed to embrace them as anything but a hinterland of centralized urbanized economies. It's a very different reality if you go 200 kilometers to the west and you arrive to Warsaw. It's a very different kind of economy and society that essentially benefited from the European integration, as we call it. These lands that I'm talking about along the border with Belarus, well, they have not, or at least the sentiment is that they essentially were failed by the European cohesion policies. So it's the arrival of global China that holds the future in terms of providing or continuing to provide labor, identity, and urbanization. There is notably a plan for building a new town next to the largest transshipment ports that would house the workers, that would also attract some Chinese investment and Chinese actors. And it is very frequently mocked by the local media. So there is as it often is the case, it's a project of a local political champion, of a particularly outspoken and active mayor of a rural community, of a village, essentially, who is very well connected, very vocal. He, as I mentioned, this strategy is very much going to China and going to Warsaw to lobby for his ideas. But I think, however distance we should be from that vision and however critical we should be of it, I think that it's very clear that without this place, these communities being at the kind of a rift between the East and West, being at the border of the EU and in Asia, and without this kind of a narrational trick that they're playing, shifting themselves from the borderlands to actually the center of Eurasia under the paradigm of global China, under this opportunity that global China holds, neither the urbanization, nor the infrastructural development, nor this kind of continued identity as a place that lives off transshipment infrastructure would be possible. It is the geopolitics that actually allow these localities to put themselves on the map or to dream of the future as something more than just rural communities at the border of a country that happens to be Poland. And I think it's really fascinating how geopolitics that is often narrated as something that kind of lands in a space and kind of dominates it, and whether it's cities or villages does not really matter. Here, actually, we see the inverse direction, where these places are really using geopolitics to kind of become more than they are, or to achieve centrality, to achieve meaning, identity, go very much also against the national currents. The national government is very suspicious about anything happening right now along the Belarusian or Ukrainian border for obvious reasons. These communities are really trying to spur development by tapping to the geopolitical opportunity, as they call it.
Thanks, Wojciech. That sounds almost like an urbanization glitch. You were talking about infrastructure glitch, but it's also an urbanization glitch. Thanks for taking us there. So we now shift back to Hong Kong and Shenzhen. Sirma, let's start with you.
Then let me begin by unpacking a little bit what I mean by the secondary positioning of Hong Kong in the 2020. So why 2020 is important, why I now tend to frame it as secondary positioning. I mentioned that now we have a recent China, now we have the context of the Second Cold War, heightened rivalry between US and China. And now we also have a heightened competition among the Chinese and Asian cities, especially the one between Hong Kong and Singapore. So in such context, what I mean by secondary positioning is composition of Hong Kong's urban spaces produced through city branding, through mega projects, and also through economic or city diplomacy practices. And this is particularly important, and I try to explain what I mean by that. But 2020 is, I believe, it's an important turning point for Hong Kong, and there are a few reasons why this is the case. Well, first, there is this pro-democracy movement, a wave of movements actually started from the 2019s, 2020s, it continued until and throughout the 2020s. And then you have COVID-19, you have the prolonged lockdown measures, and those measures were modeled after the mainland. And you also have the enactment of the national security law in the same year in 2020, and response from the US side by Hong Kong Autonomy Act again in 2020 as a countermeasure to national security law. And then again in the same year, you see that Hong Kong experiences the first recession in 10 years, but that recession was complemented with credit ranking downgrade and city ranking downgrades, which are extremely important from the official lens in terms of Hong Kong's world city image. And there's also a discussion on Hong Kong's losing of talent to Singapore, losing of capital to Singapore. So this the idea of Hong Kong losing against Singapore, again, you see the importance of it in the official framing. Then in this second repositioning, and the idea of second come from something that has been put forward by Richard Hu. He understands this transformation in Hong Kong as a reconfiguration within one country, two systems formation. And he says this is actually Hong Kong's second return to China, second return after the handover. So it may sound a bit of a dramatic shift, but this is how he frames it. And what he means actually by that, if I translate it in the language that I use in my research, that shifting of positioning of Hong Kong in the world as Asia's premier world city to a deepening integration to mainland China and mainland China's political, economic, but also spatial planning systems. So deeper integration. So now we're talking about within one country, two systems, an emphasis on the two systems, a shift from that to an emphasis on one country. So this is the idea behind the second repositioning. In terms of local responses to international political, economic shifts or geopolitical shifts, I think all of these things like city branding efforts, mega projects such as Northern Metropolis Region, but also city level diplomacy, all of these efforts show us the fact that production of space is about an interplay between local and national, and local here, the Hong Kong authorities' efforts, state efforts in level of Hong Kong. The national means mainland Chinese approach. towards Hong Kong, but not just that, but also international as well. And international is the context of the Second Cold War. So interplay between all these factors, local, national, and international. And we can also understand this as a multi-scalar analysis of what is going on in the very localities that we are looking at. In terms of the future possibilities, I see, I think the answer to this question is that future will also be made, produced through the interplay between all these scales. So, for example, you have in the second positioning mainland Chinese special planning of a mega region, Greater Bay Area. And as a response to that, from the Hong Kong side, you have the Northern Metropolis project. Or you have Shenzhen as a model, being framed as a model from the mainland Chinese special planning perspective to Hong Kong's new formation, and Hong Kong's response to it as the Santin Technopole project within the Northern Metropolis region. If I try to sum up, I see the future will also be produced through the interplay between the local, national, and international scales.
Thank you. Thanks, Irma. Maybe we go across the border to Shenzhen with Yong.
Yeah, thank you. If I could sum up my finding through the research in terms of how cities could be repositioned within this changing global economic orders, I might say it's a kind of like a conjunctural recomposition under constraint, if that's, that's the term I would like to use. We need to contextualize the idea a little bit in the sense that it's almost undeniable that Shenzhen started its dream of being a metropolis molded on the rise of Hong Kong or its geographical proximity to Hong Kong. Like Hong Kong has always been the example that Shenzhen looks up to in the early days. But increasingly, Shenzhen nowadays looks up to Singapore. When it comes to social policies, industrial policies, and land use policies. That comparison is, for myself, a striking kind of example through which we can really understand how cities are being repositioned in this changing global order. Very simply put, I don't think Shenzhen itself is, as is claimed, just, by upgrading, right? We keep talking about like cities upgrading its manufacturing bases, its talent pool, its economic connectivities, and so on and so forth. But in reality, we're witnessing more and more cities on the kind of front of previous round of globalization taking this defensive gestures, including the manufacturing tension, right? Like the very ambitious provision of manufacturing spaces and retention of the labor and talent. So in that sense, I think this is a quite bizarre conjunctural. We're seeing a lot of things happening together. It's greatly changing, I would say, people's imaginary of what the global urban future would be like when it comes to Chinese cities. Right, like there used to be an imaginary that cities should be CBD plus recreational space, right? And flying drones probably representing high tech, right? But now I think we should reconsider the importance of keeping manufacturing not just as an economic decision to make, but as a integral and a part of the urban imagery when it comes to the urban future way of thinking. Briefly, recap what I just said. I think we're seeing a very bizarre moment. Well, the cities are not moving from industrial to post-industrial kind of trajectory, but increasingly foreground this kind of like compressed production, retained or production-based urbanism. And of course, this transition is by no means smooth or unidirectional. It's selective, it's honestly fragile, and it's creating a lot of unforeseen frictions. Just give you a very brief example. Shenzhen in the 2018 has pronounced very ambitiously to keep its 30% of its land use permanently, or at least indefinitely, for manufacturing. That was a really, really bold move. And that gives a lot of people very understandably kind of an unhappy look, because they worry the housing crisis may not get any better if we foreground manufacturing spaces over the others.
Thank you, Yong. All right, I'm kind of moving towards the a final question I have, which is not final in the sense of like being a closing question, but final in the sense of a final framing rather. So how do built environments materialize competing political visions? And I guess you've sort of like talked about it, you've alluded to it, but perhaps it's also an invitation to add something to what you might have already said. So how are these competing political visions, like authoritarianism, developmentalism, socialism, how are these being sort of reformed or being materialized? And what alternative urban trajectories and forms of world making might be possible in these places that you're sort of talking from? So Wojciech, let's go to you first of all.
Great, thank you for these questions. I think indeed, as a way of adding to what I was saying before, what's quite clear to me is that this urbanization that I've observed in these borderlands of Europe, or actually very central places, if you look at them from the Eurasian perspective or an Eurasian scale, the reason for existence of this infrastructure and for this urbanization, well, this rationale is actually very malleable and very adaptable. I don't want to exaggerate and say that whoever is bringing their political vision, whatever empire, whatever center of power, or whether political or economic power is kind of affecting, influencing, or even in charge of these places, that essentially it leads to the same effect. But it's quite surprising to me that transshipment ports built by the socialist Polish People's Republic to kind of connect the Soviet Union with the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, that was also socialist, that essentially state-led socialist infrastructure now is adapted by very capitalist, very globalist interests of Western Europe or Europe writ large, and China, however socialist it might be in writing or in theory. Of course, the way that it interacts with this infrastructure is with very capitalist, very very profit driven interests. So to simplify, essentially, it's socialist infrastructure that is perfectly adaptable under global capitalism. And it doesn't really lead or necessitate any infrastructural adaptation. The way that urbanization works, perhaps, is somewhat different. And I think there we see some kind of a shift from a state-led project of building housing estates or even building new towns that are much more kind of long-term, and let's say they represent certain security and stability. And the state was, after all, a socialist state was a kind of that is also exaggerated in terms of how omnipresent and omnipowerful it was, but it was definitely very present and very powerful. Now, any kind of urbanization project in this day and age related to these logistical infrastructures is about risk-taking, is about exposing municipal authorities to projects which might come to fruition or not, but essentially they are the ones taking the risk, and the benefits are taken and reaped by private logistical companies and their workers, right? So there is a shift of logic, I would say. Still, I'm perplexed and surprised by how adaptable urbanization is, and infrastructure that this urbanization entails. Where are the alternatives? I think in this part of the world, and looking at this particular type of urbanization infrastructure, what perhaps is missing and what could be alternative is a vision where these processes of infrastructural development and urbanization related to logistics and related to already materialized but also envisioned connectivity between Europe and China, they are not competing visions. So we don't see various municipalities or local leaders or regions trying to do it on their own and try to essentially do similar things, even the same things, in disconnection from one another, or worse yet, in competition with one another. But we have some kind of an authority or authorities that try to coordinate this, that try to, well, not only limit the construction of infrastructure that could be avoided. But basically, instead of, I don't know, developing three ports at the same time, maybe we just need one, and that's enough. But where we basically try to coordinate this to limit the risk, the municipal development or the urban development of this infrastructure by local leaders, by local actors, essentially entails massive risk taking. It's trying to develop your community to bring development, modernity. It's a very colonial project. I think there's a kind of a vector of self-colonization in this. It essentially is making this livelihood and this prosperity depend on global flows of logistics, on geopolitics, on the fact that China is developing these connections with Europe, and Europe is playing along. But essentially, of course, these powers are beyond anybody's control. These communities are really betting on the golden goose, as they call it. But they have no phone number to the golden goose. They cannot talk to it. They cannot control it, let alone exactly make the goose go left or right. So this is very much, sticking your finger into the wind and hoping that, it's blowing the way that you want it to blow. And as long as it happens, everything is going more or less to plan. But if the wind changes direction, as it did when Russia invaded Ukraine, or as it did when the US attacked Iran, well, it's beyond anybody's control. And these communities are the first ones to feel that the wind stops blowing, or that it changes direction, right? That the goose does not collaborate anymore. So collaboration between these different localities, I think, would be alternative, or would entail some kind of alternative trajectory. And somewhat paradoxically, now that I think of it, I actually thought about it a little bit earlier as well, but I come to this conclusion every now and then, it surprises me. That probably calls, in this particular context, for some kind of national coordination, for a plan probably conceived, for lack of any other better actor, by the national government that would actually coordinate these urbanization processes. I know that, we are talking to urban-minded audiences, and we are urbanists or urban geographers ourselves, but let's not forget about the national level and the national state that could have a role in this process, especially in terms of mitigating the risks that these local communities, cities, towns are taking. That's, I think, where I would begin my answer to these, again, very engaging and very broad questions.
Thank you, Wojciech. Let's hear from Sirma.
I think I like to say a few more words about city diplomacy in the case of Hong Kong. I want to do that because I want to continue from where I left in terms of the relations between local, national, and international. And when we try to understand the imaginations in the locality, in the case of Hong Kong, for example, I think we have to always consider Hong Kong's relationships with the world. In that sense, city diplomacy, and especially in the recent period, Hong Kong's city diplomacy efforts towards the Middle East plays an important role. And in terms of the competing visions, I think I like to say a few words about US Middle East and Hong Kong Middle East approaches in very recently in 2025. So as you know, Trump visited Middle East in May 2025, to be more specific, from 13th to 16th May 2025. He visited Qatar, UAE, and Saudi Arabia, and it was a big deal. And it's interpreted, I think, from a very problematic perspective, that US comes back to Middle East, kicks out Chinese and Chinese engagements, ends, and now US is back, kind of interpretations. When we shift from the national, from the US to the local, to the Hong Kong, we actually see that Hong Kong initiated, Hong Kong delegation, including chief executive, initiated a Middle East tour in the exactly same period, from 12th to 14th May 2025, visited almost the same places, like chief executive visited Qatar and Kuwait. And they also framed it as a big indicator, strong indicator of how Chinese and Middle East relations have been on the go. So the scales, I think this example shows us the importance of scales, and also the importance of city imaginations and the importance of looking at the relationship between the cities and elsewhere to see how these imaginations are framed. And This is very much, I think, related to the alternative imaginations or alternative projections of urban form or production of space on the urban level as well. And to think about these alternative imaginations, I think the question of who gets what plays a really, really critical role. And I'm saying this because this is a question of whether Hong Kong will invest its resources for opening new Invest Hong Kong branches abroad and allocating its talent, allocating its financial resources to build its stronghold abroad, or will the resources allocated to solve the very urgent problem of housing inequality in Hong Kong, for example. I think the stark contrast between the two gives us a perspective towards alternative imaginations and how competing visions kind of, I don't want to say determine, but play a significant role in terms of the production of space. Yeah, that's how I will answer your question.
Thank you, Sima. That was very illuminating. Yong, would you like to go in next?
I think I largely agree with both Wojciech and Sima in terms of the limited agency like cities would have to define its own future, because nation state and global relations and conditions still largely shape what a single city can do. But in terms of my research, I would like to, again, kind of draw upon like the Shenzhen case, through especially its urban regeneration past shift. So we know like China in recent years has been championing the domestic so-called high quality development. And if you bother to check whatever search engine you could have and ask why China is doing this, a lot of answers will suggest that, oh, it's because the international relations deteriorate. So China has to emphasize domestic development through more of a consumption-based rather than a previously export-oriented development model, right? That's largely true. And it also give rise to this championship of the idea of inclusive development. So basically, it means on the ground, cities no longer take this previously dominant slash and rebuild kind of approach when it comes to urban regeneration. And instead, they allow a more negotiated and of course, in time-wise and also lengthy process of slow and incremental retrofitting and urban redevelopment, broadly speaking. I think it's too early to really judge whether we are entering into a new phase, because those models, those emerging alternatives, they have, they are still largely, I believe, in, through my research, like have find its roots in the previous period of time. For example, when it comes to the urban redevelopment in Shenzhen, and when the government has repetitively say, oh, we're no longer adopting this slash rebuild model, that local people are not satisfied, because their dream of getting rich quick through this urban regime is evaporated. Right, so that does not please everybody. On top of that, this very inclusive language usage, such as high quality development, livability, and community, which are increasingly circulated on the, in the media and the policy documents, still find its kind of, in my opinion, roots in the idea of production primary. So if we don't wrap the very idea of inclusivity and livability through the idea of competitiveness, right? So we cannot really say we're entering into a different future or an alternative trajectory. So I guess my answer to that question in a nutshell would be like, so what appears as those alternative trajectories at best can be called a selective adaptation. That's my answer to that.
Thank you. That was quite a wonderful conversation. I'm so packed with ideas. I mean, I would like to maybe offer an open mic if any of you have anything to add, or if there's things that you want to say to each other. We do have a little bit of time. Sirma, I see you.
Yeah, I think what I like to say is, and this podcast is just a very good indication of it. When we talk about Second Cold War cities, we talk about a totality. And we shouldn't undermine the totality, and totality is the Second Cold War, or however we call it. Like now here, we like to call it the Second Cold War. And this totality is an uneven and combined totality. So cities are integrated into this totality by different forms of production of space, different forms of city branding, different forms of geopolitical positioning. But the fact that all the examples that we've been talking about today is kind of in relation to each other, or they all have some common grounds, the shifts have some common grounds, I think it should always led us to consider the totality of the Second Cold War cities and uneven and combined totality of them. So that's what I wanted to add.
Maybe building on this, I'm curious, I still don't have the answer to myself regarding my own research and your respective projects, which I have great respect for, and I've learned a lot about from in this conversation, and also earlier when we were meeting earlier this year. I'm not sure what is new about this new kind of direction of constructing this new totality that is the Second Cold War, and what is actually the same kind of dynamic of local urban actors being essentially exposed to the wind of geopolitics or geoeconomics, where they do a lot of risk taking in order to achieve some kind of, you know, development, prosperity, labor, meaning as well, identity, and when it works, they take all the credit, and they become the powerhouses, the economic locomotives, or the command and control centers. Right, I'm thinking here about Hong Kong, that curiously we all related to in this group, although in different capacities. I think that's also quite symbolic. But then, of course, when it does not work, it's often the cities themselves that are being blamed for it, right, for not being competitive enough, or not being creative enough, or for being located in all kind of wrong places. So I think in this sense, it's very much the same. It's very much the same kind of direction. But perhaps, of course, the framing of it and these geoeconomic and geopolitical powers that frame this never-ending competition for cities, never-ending risk-taking endeavor, these powers might be quite different.
I don't think we necessarily have to call it Second Cold War or whatever. But what I mean, I also agree with the value of calling it Second Cold War. But that's another discussion. What I mean by totality, I think the totality of global capitalism and the shifts, overall shifts in that. So the transformations in global capitalism. So I think like the gist of it is global capitalism, and now through global there are like dramatic shifts and transformations going on, and some people, including myself, decide to call it Second Cold War. So this is the idea. Okay.
Yeah, I would like to throw in some ideas for you guys to comment on, because I haven't got a clear kind of answer to this question, right? Because I was suddenly reminded by, you know, all of you in this, through this conversation, the idea of a restoration of class control, a la apparently the Dewey Harvey. So Harvey used to famously say like the neoliberalism is a project of restoration of class control, right? Of course, that idea has been heavily critiqued and discussed. So I wonder if we borrow that idea and try to transplant it to a certain extent, right, to this idea of Second Cold War, I think we're literally seeing a kind of a restoration of the state power in a lot of sense. The many projects that didn't go as smoothly as before now has a better vehicle to be carried through, to be pushed forward through the idea of national interests and so on, right? Because, you know, of the global rivalry. If we take the two restoration at the same time, right? One is a class control, and the other is a state control. right? Does that make our urban future more polarizing or less so? Right. Apparently, those are terms which we can think about what is going on. But I think the framing of Second Cold War is also a reminder that if the great power going forward kind of unchecked, right, then it's not necessarily an empowering inclusive project as you know they it's often championed.
I have a quick response to this. Yeah. Maybe it's not an answer to your questions, which are also very good, but I'm wondering to what extent, actually to Serma's point as well about global capitalism, it is possible also, and some people have been writing about this, that this is not about capitalism anymore, but more this techno-feudalist development of techno-feudalist future, where indeed capitalism has morphed into some kind of different economic system, and therefore also state as a facade or as a kind of a, yeah, as a framing very much still is there, or perhaps in narrational terms, it has a lot of power, right? China versus US and then Russia and, well, I don't know where Europe is in all this, but fair enough. But actually, a lot of the capital concentration and a lot of the geoeconomic power is held by private entities, Amazon, Google, and the like. It erodes severely the state's power to control this project or to kind of give it direction. I mean, just a little wrench to be thrown into the wheels of our thinking here. Certainly, it's not black and white.
Yeah, right. But we should also keep in mind that there's another literature on state capitalism as well. but it's really good that we have. I think these are really fantastic discussions, and all of these discussions have implications in terms of the urban form. So, but don't underestimate state capitalism literature as well.
Or the specter of
absolutely
state
right.
capitalism.
Absolutely yeah. right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's just different ways of understanding what's going on, and there's different things going on. That's it.
Great. Thank you. That's a great note to end this episode on. So thanks, Wojciech. Thanks, Irma. Thanks, Yong. Thanks for taking the time for exploring this puzzle for our listeners. This is a great conversation. I learned a lot about how the urban political economy of geopolitical world making is taking shape in these different places that you are reporting from and talking about. It was truly enriching. Thank you. And join us in the next and final episode of this mini series on everyday geopolitics, where we'll be joined by Sarah Smith, Joanna Kochis, and Umesh Marmudali to bring yet another part of this bigger puzzle on cities and geopolitics for us. If you liked today's episode, please share it with your friends. Send us an email. We love receiving fan emails. If you have podcast ideas or would like to be involved, please do drop us an email as well.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigee.io.